There were also frequent instances of physical ailments being cured by the laying on of hands. Amicable relations were re-established with the black people in Australia and New Guinea who came to visit them regularly on chariots of fire, as they sometimes call the spaceships still being used by their Australian brothers. The yellow race, being closer neighbours, began to immigrate, in small numbers, to northern Africa, and were fascinated by the tales of the arrival of God on a chariot of fire. This is how the legends subsequently referred to our intervention. The yellow people were the first to mix with the black race, physically speaking, I mean. It might be surprising, but never, on Bukharatini, had the race mixed to the extent that they did on Earth. The ethnologists were greatly interested in the results of this union, which produced on Earth a great new tribe. Indeed, these crossbreeds, as I'll call them, being crossed with more yellow blood than black, ended up feeling more at ease among themselves than with either black or yellow. Eventually, they grouped together and settled in the area now called Algeria, Tunisia, North Africa. Thus, a new race was born, the Arab race that you know. Don't think, though, they immediately resembled the race they are now. Climate and time, the passing of centuries, had its effect. My story simply gives you the idea of how the race began through interbreeding. And so, all was going well for the inhabitants of the planet Earth, except for one thing. The astronomers and scholars were very worried, for an enormous asteroid was approaching Earth, almost imperceptibly, but unmistakably. It was first picked up by the observatory of Ekaireto, located in the center of Australia. After several months, it could be seen by the naked eye, provided one knew where to look, glowing a most sinister, vivid red. In the weeks to follow, it became ever more readily visible. The governments of Australia, New Guinea and Antarctica made a most important decision, which was soon agreed to by the yellow leaders. Ahead of the inevitable collision with the asteroid, they agreed that all space vessels in a condition to fly would leave Earth, carrying on board as many specialists and experts as possible, doctors, technicians, etc., of the kind most likely to be of service to the community following the catastrophe. Where were they going? To the moon? No, Michelle, at that time Earth didn't have a moon. Their spacecraft were now capable of 12 weeks autonomous flight. For a long time, their capability for super long distance travel had been lost to them. Their plan was to remain in orbit around the Earth, ready to land as soon as possible and give assistance where it was most needed. 80 Australian spacecraft were equipped and loaded to carry an elite group, which was chosen as a result of meetings held day and night. The yellow race followed the same procedure, making 98 spacecraft ready. In Africa, of course, there had never been any spaceships. I ask you to note, in passing, that apart from the supreme leader of each country, none of his ministers, as you might call them, was given a place on any vessel. This will probably seem odd to you, for if the same situation were to occur today on Earth, many politicians would be pulling strings to save their own skins. Thou turned our vehicle, and in a few moments, we had left the forest tops and were flying over a plain, across which flowed a jade-green river. We descended to an altitude of about 3 meters and followed its course. Now we were able to follow the movements of strange fish, fish that resembled platypuses more than fish, as I knew them to be. The water was pure, like crystal, and at this altitude we could distinguish everything down to the smallest pebble. Looking up, I saw we were approaching the ocean. Palm trees resembling coconut palms waved their majestic fronds at impressive heights, on the edge of a beach of golden sands. The blue of the ocean contrasted pleasantly with the bright red of rocks encrusted in small hills, which overlooked a section of its beach. 100 or so people basked on the sand or swam, entirely naked, in the transparent waters of the ocean. I felt a little dazed, not only because of the new and wondrous things I was constantly discovering, but also because of the perpetual sensation of lightness, due to the change in gravity. This sensation was my reminder of Earth, what a strange word, and how difficult it was to visualize Earth now. The auditory and visual vibrations were also affecting my nervous system enormously. Usually a highly strung person, I was feeling completely relaxed, as if I had plunged into a warm bath, allowing myself to float in the bubbles while soft music played. No, even more relaxed than that, so relaxed I felt like crying. We proceeded, quite rapidly, across the waters of the immense bay, flying about 12 meters above the waves. On the horizon, I could distinguish several dots, some larger than others, and I realized these were islands, no doubt those I had seen prior to our landing on Thaouba. As we headed for the smallest island, I looked below and saw that we were being followed by numerous fish, amusing themselves by crisscrossing the shadow our vehicle projected on the water. "Are they sharks?" I asked. "No, they're Dajex, the brothers of your dolphin. You see? They are as fond of playing as your dolphins are. Look," I interrupted Thal. "Look." Thal looked to where I was pointing and began laughing. I was astonished to see a group of people approaching us, seemingly without the aid of a vehicle. They were about 2 meters above the water, in a vertical position, and not only floating in the air, but moving quite rapidly towards us. Soon our paths crossed and granted gestures of friendship were exchanged. At the same instant, a wave of well-being flowed through me lasting several seconds. It was the same sensation Latli had produced and I recognized it as a sign of greeting from these flying people. "How do they do that? Is it levitation?" "No, they have a taro. The taro is an apparatus worn like a belt when you wish to fly, on their waists and a litialak. The litialak works in concert with the taro to fly, but is held in the hand, in their hands. These produce certain vibrations that neutralize the cold magnetic force of the planet, allowing neutralization of the gravitational force. Even a weight of millions of tons compares with it of feathers. Then, by other vibrations resembling those of ultrasound, they can steer themselves precisely to wherever they choose, as they are doing now. On this planet, everyone wanting to travel some distance uses this method." "Then why are we using this vehicle?" I asked, for I would have loved to experiment with such equipment, which, by the way, was absolutely noiseless. "Michelle, you are impatient. I have brought you by this means because you are not capable of flying with a litialak. Without practice, you could hurt yourself. Later, perhaps, if there is time, I will teach you how to use it. Look, we are nearly there." Indeed, we were fast approaching an island and could clearly see a golden beach where several people basked in the sun. Almost immediately, we were flying beneath palm fronds along a wide path, bordered with two rows of flowering and very fragrant bushes. The area was alive with the sound and color of insects, butterflies and birds. The vehicle proceeded slowly at ground level and, after a final bend in the path, we arrived before a little egg, nestled among small trees and flowering vines. It seemed that every building on this planet had the shape of an egg, most often lying on their sides but occasionally upright, as I have said, with the pointed end upwards. The shells were off-white in color and had no windows or doors. This particular egg lay on its side, apparently half buried in the ground. It was about 30 meters long and 20 meters in diameter, quite small in comparison with those I had seen so far. Thou stopped the vehicle in front of a bright light centered on the wall of the egg. Leaving the platform, we entered the habitation. As we did so, I felt a light pressure, with no more force than the weight of an eiderdown. I remembered experiencing the same sensation earlier, when we passed through the wall of the space center. Having neither doors nor windows on these buildings is extraordinary in itself, but once inside, it was stranger still. As I have mentioned before, the overall impression was of still being outside. The startling beauty of color was everywhere, the greenery, the branches of the trees dissecting the blue mauve sky above, the butterflies, the flowers. I recall a bird that came to rest right in the middle of the roof, so that we could see the bottom of its feet. It was as though it had miraculously stopped in midair. The effect was quite extraordinary. The only contrast with the outside was provided by the floor that was covered in a type of carpet on which were arranged comfortable-looking seats and large pedestal tables. All of these furnishings were, of course, on a large scale, appropriate to these large-scale people. "So," I asked, "how are your walls transparent and yet we can't see in from the outside? And how can we pass through your walls as we did? First of all, Michelle, let's take off this mask of yours. I will regulate the internal light so that it will be bearable for you." Thou approached an object on the floor and touched it. When I removed my mask, I found the light to be no less tolerable than with it on, although the shiny quality was restored. "You see, Michelle, this habitation exists because of a magnetic field that is quite special. We have copied the forces of nature and the creations of nature to our own ends. Let me explain. Every body, human, animal or mineral, possesses a field around itself. The human body, for example, is surrounded both by an aura and by an etheric force field of oval shape. You know that, don't you?" I nodded. "The latter comprises, in part, electricity and, to a greater extent, vibrations that we call ariakostinarchy. These vibrations occur continuously for your protection while you are alive, and they are not to be confused with the vibrations of the aura. With our habitations, we have copied nature in creating a field of mineral electroetheric vibrations around a nucleus." Thou indicated an egg, the size of an ostrich egg, located in the middle of the room between two seats. "Will you push this seat, please, Michelle?" I looked at Thou, surprised by her request, considering the size of the seat and the fact that she had never before asked anything of me. I tried to oblige, but with some difficulty, for the seat was indeed heavy. However, I succeeded in moving it about 50 centimeters. "Very good," she said. "Now you will pass me the egg." I smiled. In comparison, this would be a simple task. I could lift it with one hand and without any effort, but in order not to drop it, I took it in two hands and fell to my knees. I had not expected it to be so heavy and had overbalanced. I stood up and tried again, this time with all my strength. Nothing happened. Thou touched my shoulder. "Watch," she said. Turning towards the seat I had found so difficult to move, she placed one hand under it and raised it above her head. Still with one hand, she set it down again, apparently with no effort. Next, she took the egg in both hands and pushed and pulled with all her might till the veins swelled in her neck. Still the egg didn't move a tenth of a millimeter. "It is welded to the floor," I suggested. "No, Michelle, it is the center and cannot move. It is the nucleus I spoke of earlier. We have created a field around it, so strong that the wind and the rain can't penetrate this field. As for the sun's rays, we can regulate the extent to which they penetrate. The birds too, which come to rest above, are not heavy enough to pass through the field and, if by chance a heavier bird does land, he will start to sink. This produces such a frightening sensation for the bird that he will fly away immediately without having come to any harm." "It's so ingenious," I said, "but what is the significance of the light at the entrance? Couldn't we pass through the walls anywhere we chose?" "Indeed, we could. It's just that from the outside, it's not possible to see the interior, and so you can't know that you won't hit a piece of furniture on the other side. The best place to enter is always indicated by an external light. Come, let me show you around." I followed her and discovered, behind a richly decorated partition, a truly magnificent setting. There was a miniature swimming pool that seemed to be of green porphyry and, nearby, a matching basin over which a porphyry swan was bending, its beak open. The effect was beautiful. Thou held her hand under the swan's beak and immediately the water began to flow over her hand and into the basin. She withdrew it and the flow ceased. She indicated that I should dry. The basin was about 150 centimeters above the floor, so that I had to lift my arm quite high, but I managed and the water spurted out again. "How clever," I explained. Do you have water which is drinkable on this island, or have you had to sink, Bors? Again Thou's face lit with her smile of amusement. It was quite familiar to me, appearing each time I said something that, to her, seemed quaint. No, Michelle, we don't procure our water as you do on Earth. Under this magnificent stone bird, is an apparatus which draws air from outside and transforms it into drinking water, as required. That's wonderful. We are merely exploiting a natural law. And what if you want hot water? Electrovibratory force. For warm water, you put your foot here, and for boiling water, you put it there. Cells positioned on the side control the functioning of the apparatus. But these are only material details and of no great significance. This here, said Thou, following the direction of my gaze, is the relaxation area. You can stretch out there. She pointed to a thick mat that was on the floor, a little further down towards the base of the egg. I lay down and immediately felt as though I were floating at ground level. Although she continued to speak, I could no longer hear Thou's voice. She had disappeared behind the misty curtain, so that I had the impression of being enveloped in a thick fog of cotton wool. At the same time, musical vibrations could be heard, and the total effect was marvelously relaxing. I stood up again and after several seconds, Thou's voice was audible again, growing louder as the fog lifted and disappeared completely. What do you think of that, Michelle? It really is the height of comfort. I replied enthusiastically. But there is one thing I haven't yet seen, and that is the kitchen, and you know how important the kitchen is to the French. This way, she said, smiling again and taking several steps in another direction. Do you see this transparent drawer? Inside you have various compartments. From left to right, fish, shellfish, eggs, cheese, dairy products, vegetables and fruits, and here in the last, we have what you call manna, which is our bread. Either you are teasing me or you are making fun of me. All I see in your drawer is red, green, blue, brown and blends of these colors. What you see are concentrates of the various foods, fish, vegetables etc., of the best quality prepared by excellent cooks using various special methods. When you taste it, you will find all this food excellent and very nourishing. Thou then uttered several words in her own language and, in a few moments, I had before me on a tray, selected items of food arranged in a manner pleasing to the eye. When I tasted it, my palate was agreeably surprised. It was indeed excellent, although very different from anything I had ever eaten before in my life. The manna I had already tasted in the spaceship. I ate some of it again and found it a good accompaniment to the dishes presented. You tell me that, on Earth, this bread is known as manna. How is it that it exists on Earth at all? It is a product we always carry on our intergalactic spacecraft. It is very practical, being easily compressed and highly nourishing. In fact, it's a complete food. It comes from wheat and oats and you could live on it alone for months. Just then, our attention was drawn by the approach of some people, flying at ground level beneath the branches of the trees. They sat down at the entrance to the egg, unfastened their taras and placed them on a block of marble, no doubt there for the purpose. One after the other, they entered and I recognized with pleasure Biastra and Latley and the rest of the crew from the spacecraft. They had changed from their space uniforms into long Arabian-style robes of shimmering colors. Later, I was to understand why the color of each robe was so flattering to the individual who wore it. For the moment, it was difficult to believe these were the same people I had known and spoken with on the spacecraft. They were so completely transformed. Latley approached me, a radiant smile lighting up her face. Placing her hand on my shoulder, she said, telepathically, "You seem somewhat stunned, my dear. Are our habitations not to your liking?" She read my affirmative and admiring response and was delighted by it. Turning back to the others, she relayed my response, and comments flew thick and fast, everyone talking at once. They had all sat down, looking much more at home in their seats than I felt in mine. I felt as odd as a duckling among chickens in that my size corresponded with nothing that had been built on their scale. Thou went to the kitchen and filled a tray with things to eat. Then, at a word from her, all hands were held out in the direction of the tray, which rose slowly in the air. It moved around the room, stopping before each guest, without her having to touch it. Finally, it stopped in front of me and, with great caution, lest it fall, which vastly amused everyone, I took a glass of hydromel. The tray departed of its own accord, returning to its place of origin, and all hands were lowered. How is that done? I asked Thou. My question was understood telepathically by everyone and there was a general burst of laughter. By what you would call levitation, Michelle. We can, as readily, lift ourselves in the air, but that serves no great purpose other than our own amusement. Having said that, Thou, who was sitting cross-legged, began to rise above her seat and floated about the room, finally coming to rest in midair. I stared at her, but soon realized I was the only one fascinated by her accomplishment. Indeed, I must have looked idiotic, for all eyes were fixed on me. Evidently, Thou's behavior was perfectly normal to my friends, but they were more interested in the astonished expression on my face. Thou descended slowly onto her seat. That demonstrates one of the many sciences you have lost on Earth, Michelle, apart from a few individuals who are still capable of doing it. There was a time when it was practiced by many, along with many other skills. We passed the time pleasantly that afternoon, my new friends and I, communicating telepathically in a light-hearted way, until the sun was low in the sky. Then Thou explained, Michelle, this Doko, as we call our habitations on this planet, will be your home during your brief stay on Thiuba. We'll be leaving you now for the night, to let you sleep. If you wish to bathe, you know how to arrange it and you can sleep on the relaxation bed. But try to be organized within the next half hour, as there is no lighting in this habitation. We are able to see as well by night, as by day, and have no need of it. Is this building secure? Am I safe here? I asked worriedly. Again Thou smiled. On this planet, you could sleep on the ground in the middle of town and you would be safer than in a building with armed guards, dogs and alarms on Earth. Here, we have only very evolved beings and certainly, none resembling the criminals you have on Earth. In our eyes, they must be likened to the worst of savage beasts. On that note, good night. Thou about turned and passed through the wall of the Doko to rejoin her friends. They must have brought a little luck for her because she flew off with the group. I prepared then, to spend my first night on Thiuba. Chapter 6. The Seven Masters and the Aura. A huge flame burned blue, orange, yellow and red flames burned around it. An enormous black snake slid straight through the flames, heading for me. Giants appeared from nowhere, running, and trying to catch the snake. It took seven of them together, to stop it before it reached me. But it turned and swallowed the flames, only to spit them back out, like a dragon, at the giants. They were transformed into immense statues just as they were, mounted on the tail of the snake. The reptile became a comet and carried the statues off, to Easter Island, an isolated island in the Pacific with no trees, several thousand kilometers from the shore of Chile, on which there are numerous gigantic statues from stone. Some of these statues are 50 meters high and since time immemorial have been considered one of the seven wonders of the world. Their existence has intrigued archaeologists and historians for centuries. Editors comment in agreement with the author. Next, they were greeting me, wearing strange hats. One of the statues, resembling Thou, caught me by the shoulder and said, Michelle, Michelle. Wake up. Thou was shaking me and gently smiling. My goodness. I said, opening my eyes, I was dreaming you were an Easter Island statue and that you caught hold of me by the shoulder. I am an Easter Island statue, and I did take you by the shoulder. Anyway, I'm not dreaming now, am I? No, but your dream was really quite strange, For on Easter Island, there is a statue which was sculptured a very long time ago to immortalize me and which was given my name. What are you telling me now? The simple truth, Michelle, but we will explain all that to you in good time. For now, we will try on these clothes I've brought for you. Thou handed me a richly colored robe which quite delighted me and, after a warm and perfumed bath, I dressed in the garment. A feeling of euphoria, which was totally unexpected, overwhelmed me. I mentioned it to Thou, who was waiting with a glass of milk and a little manna for me. The colors of your robe were chosen according to those of your aura, that's why you feel so good. If people on earth were able to see auras, they too could choose colors, which suit them and thereby enhance their feeling of well-being. They'd make use of color rather than aspirin. What do you mean, exactly? I'll give you an example. Do you ever remember saying of someone, oh, those clothes don't suit you at all? He, or she, has no taste? Yes, quite often, in fact. Well, in such cases, those people have simply chosen their clothes less skillfully than others, or mixed them less successfully. As you say in French, they don't or clash, but more in the eyes of others than in their own. However, such people will not feel good in themselves, without realizing why. If you were to suggest it was because of the colors they were wearing, they would think you odd. You could explain that the vibrations of the colors were in discord with those of their auras, but they would be no more inclined to believe you. On your planet, people only believe in what they see or touch. And yet the aura can be seen. The aura is actually colored. Of course. The aura vibrates constantly with colors that vary. At the top of your head is a veritable bouquet of colors, where almost all the colors you know are represented. Around the head too, is a golden halo, but it is only really obvious in the most highly spiritual people and in those who have sacrificed themselves in order to help someone else. The halo resembles a golden mist, much like painters on earth depict the halos of saints and of Christ. The halos were included in their paintings because, in those times, some of the artists actually saw them. Yes, I have heard mention of that, but I love to hear it from you. The colors are all there in the aura, some shine more strongly, others are dull. People in poor health, for example, or people with bad intentions. I would like so much to see the aura. I know there are people who can see it. Many people on earth could see it and read it a very long time ago, but there are few now. Calm yourself, Michelle. You will see it, and not only one but several. Including your own. Now, though, I'll ask you to follow me, because we have so much to show you and little time available. I followed Thou, who placed my mask on my face and led the way to the flying platform we had used the day before. We took our places and immediately Thou began maneuvering the machine so that it dodged below the branches of trees. In a matter of moments, we had emerged on the beach. The sun had just risen behind the island and lit up the ocean and surrounding islands. From water level, the effect was magical. As we proceeded along the beach, I could see other dokkas through the foliage, nestled among flowering bushes. On the beach, the inhabitants of these dwellings bathed in transparent waters or strolled together on the sand. Apparently surprised to see our flying platform, they followed our progress as we passed. It occurred to me that this was not the usual means of transport on the island. I should mention too, although swimmers and sunbathers are always completely naked on Thaiuba, those who stroll or move any significant distance, always dress to do so. On this planet, there is neither hypocrisy, exhibitionism nor false modesty, this will be explained later. It was not long before we reached the end of the island and, accelerating, Thou guided the vehicle at water level. We headed in the direction of a large island, which could be seen on the horizon. I could not help but admire the dexterity with which Thou piloted the flying machine, especially when we arrived at the shore of the island. Approaching the coast, I could recognize enormous dokkas, their points as usual towards the sky. I counted a group of 9, but the island was sprinkled with others, smaller and less visible amongst the vegetation. Thou took us higher and we were soon flying over what Thou called Quatrico Dojdoko, the city of the nine dokos. Skillfully, Thou brought us down between the dokos, to a beautiful park located in their midst.